Welcome back to the Curtis Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're going to be exploring 10 really significant historical events, things that fundamentally shaped the Afrin region, all happening before 2010.
That's right. Afrin, which, you know, historically has these evocative names, Siyah-i Kurmenk, the Mountain of the Kurds in Kurdish.
And Jabal al-Akrad in Arabic.
Exactly. It's this highland area, northwestern Syria, right up against the Turkish border. Part of the limestone massif.
And its history is incredibly long. We're talking human settlement stretching way back, like Neolithic period long.
It really is deep history. And while it's known for its predominantly Kurdish population, it's always been a place with a mix of communities over the millennia.
Plus, its location is key, isn't it? It's sort of a crossroads for different empires.
Absolutely. Which means it was often contested territory. A lot of different powers wanted control of that area.
So our mission today is basically to unpack those key moments before 2010, the ones that really left a mark on Afrin's politics, its society, its culture.
Yeah, we've pinpointed 10 events that we think are crucial for understanding that evolution.
Okay, let's list them out so everyone knows what we'll be covering. First, there's the founding and flourishing of Siris or Nibihuri. That's roughly 300 BC to the 6th century AD.
Second, its integration into the Roman Empire, starting around 64 BC.
Third, the Muslim conquest from 637 AD onwards, a big shift.
Fourth, the consolidation of Kurdish settlement and identity, especially notable between the 16th and 18th centuries.
Fifth, how it fit into the Ottoman administrative system, again from around the 16th century up to 1918.
Sixth, the establishment of Afrin town itself as a regional hub, mainly in the 19th century.
Seventh, a really big one.
Uh-huh.
The drawing of the Syria-Turkey border, 1921 to 1923.
Eighth, the French mandate period administration, development, all that from 1920 to 1946.
Ninth, another major geopolitical event, Turkey's annexation of Hatay, which effectively encircled Afrin between 1937 and 39.
And finally, number 10, the era of Bayeth rule, post-1963 up to 2009, focusing on the marginalization and denial of Kurdish identity.
Okay, quite a list. Let's dive into the first one. Siris, or Nibihuri.
Right. So Siris, near where Nibihuri is today, this was really the earliest major urban center in the Afrin region that we have good records for. It gets founded around 300 BC.
And founded by Seleucus Nicator, one of Alexander the Great's generals who carved out his own empire, the Seleucids.
Exactly. And its location was no accident. It was strategically placed on that major route between Antioch, a huge Hellenistic city, and Zeugma on the Euphrates, plus right near the Afrin River itself.
Makes sense. And the name Siris, that points to its Hellenistic roots too, right? Named after a city in Macedonia.
Precisely. It shows those connections right from the start. Then, fast forward a bit. 64 BC, the Romans arrive under Pompey.
And Syria becomes a Roman province, so Siris gets incorporated.
Yes, and this is when it seems to really flourish. It wasn't just some backwater town. It became a proper Roman administrative center, a military base. They even stationed Legio X Fratensis there for a time.
Wow, a full legion. That's significant. Legio X Fratensis, they were involved in major campaigns, like the Jewish revolt later on. Stationing them there tells you Rome saw this area as strategically vital.
Absolutely vital. It was a commercial hub, too, important enough to mint its own coins. It shows real status within the Roman system.
You can just picture it, controlling trade, managing the frontier with, you know, Armenia to the north and the Parthian, later Sassanid, empires to the east. A legion base makes perfect sense there.
Exactly. And then as the empire transitions, it becomes Byzantine Siris or Hagiopolis, the Holy City.
Holy City. Why the change?
It became a major Christian pilgrimage site. Apparently, the relics of Saints Cosmas and Damian, who were physicians, were believed to be there.
Ah, okay. So it gained religious importance.
Big time. Emperor Justinian I, in the 6th century, even invested in enhancing its fortifications. He clearly saw its value, both strategic and religious.
Incredibly, some of that history is still visible on the ground today.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's a Roman theater, a couple of Roman bridges that are apparently still functional, which is just mind-blowing. Foundations of a basilica, parts of the fortifications.
And that Roman tower tomb that later gets incorporated into the Nibihuri shrine. That layering in history is fascinating.
It really is. It shows how the site remained important across different eras and cultures. Siris really sets the stage, showing how deeply rooted the Afrin Valley is in ancient history and connected to these major empires.
Okay, so that flows naturally into our second event, the broader integration into the Roman Empire from 64 BC. We touched on it with Siris, but what did it mean for the region as a whole?
Well, it brought stability, for one thing. and Roman organization. The whole Afrin area became part of the province of Syria, later specifically Coele Syria, and even later Euphratensis.
And did the Romans have a specific name for the Afrin Valley itself?
They did, interestingly. Sources suggest they called it Euphrenus.
Euphrenus. You can definitely hear the echo of Afrin in there. So Roman rule wasn't just about military presence. It was about administration and development, too.
Yes, absolutely. Roman administration fostered development. Cyrus, as we said, was key. But they likely invested in infrastructure more broadly, roads to link settlements and move troops, those bridges. It was all about facilitating control and commerce.
And it remained a frontier zone, facing east towards Parthia and Persia.
A crucial frontier zone. So the military aspect was always present, but the Roman administrative structures, the place names like Euphrenus, they show this external imperial influence shaping the region. It's a pattern we'll see again.
And those investments in trade routes and maybe agriculture, like olive oil, could that have laid groundwork for later economic patterns?
It's very likely. Roman focus on stability and infrastructure often boosted local economies. Olive cultivation, which became so important later, might well have roots or received a boost during this period. Imperial priorities often have long-lasting economic effects.
Right. Okay, now for a major shift. Event number 3. The Muslim conquest, starting around 637 AD.
Yes, this is the fundamental turning point. The Byzantine Empire loses the region to the armies of the Rashidun Caliphate.
So Afrin becomes part of the Islamic world. Administratively, where did it fit in?
It became part of Jum-Kinasrin, which was one of the military administrative districts set up by the Umayyad Caliphate, centered around Kinasrin, south of Aleppo.
A whole new political and cultural alignment.
Yeah.
What happened over the next few centuries? Did rule stay stable?
Not entirely stable, no. After the Umayyads and Abbasids, you had periods of more localized rule, like the Hamdanids based in Aleppo, who were semi-independent.
And the Crusades impacted the area, too.
They did, briefly. Parts of the region, maybe including Cyrus for a time, fell under the control of the Crusader Principality of Antioch. But Muslim rule was reasserted fairly quickly. Figures like Nur ad-Din Zangi recaptured Cyrus around 1150.
So it remained a contested borderland, even then.
Very much so. Then came the Mongol invasions, which swept through the area. And later, it fell under the control of the Mamluk Sultanate based in Egypt and Syria.
And what happened to Cyrus during this time? Did it remain important?
Actually, sources suggest it went into decline. By the 13th century, travelers described it as largely ruined. Perhaps the administrative focus shifted more decisively to Aleppo under the Mamluks and later Ottomans.
But the site wasn't abandoned entirely. We mentioned the shrine.
Exactly. During the Mamluk period in 1303, that old Roman tower tomb at Cyrus was converted into the Muslim shrine of Nibi Huri, and a mosque was built nearby shortly after.
That's a perfect example of cultural layering, adapting older structures.
It really is, and it shows continued significance just in a different way. But the overall period highlights Afrin's position caught between Byzantines and Caliphates, Crusaders and Muslim rulers, Mongols and Mamluks, always on an edge.
Okay, let's shift focus to the people themselves. Event 4, the consolidation of Kurdish settlement and identity, particularly highlighted from the 16th to 18th centuries.
Right. Now, pinning down the exact timeline of Kurdish settlement is complex, and there are different accounts. Some suggest a much earlier presence.
But the evidence becomes clearer during the Ottoman era.
Much clearer. We start seeing more explicit references. Like that British traveler in 1599 who mentions Kurds in the region, possibly referring to Yazidi Kurds.
And significantly, the Ottomans themselves seem to have recognized the region's Kurdish character quite formally.
They absolutely did. Ottoman administrative language used the term Kurd-da Mountain of the Kurds.
And the Arabic equivalent was Jabal al-Akrad.
Correct. And locally, Kurds used Chie Kermik, which means the same thing. By the 18th century, Ottoman documents were even identifying the area as the Sancak of the Kurds.
Sancak being an administrative district, that's pretty strong official recognition. Did this mean anything in practical terms for the Kurds living there?
It certainly acknowledged the demographic reality. While it probably didn't translate into modern minority rights, it likely shaped how local administration functioned and how the Ottomans interacted with the population. They knew who lived there.
And sources mention powerful Kurdish tribes being influential.
Yes. Large tribal confederations like the Reshwan and Mili had influence across northern Syria, including Afrin. But within Kurd-Dag itself, you had specific tribes associated with different sub-districts.
Like the Amki, Bidi, Shaki tribes in some areas, Kosti in another, Jumi near Jindaris.
Exactly, and others like the Shikaki, Robari, Shirewi in the east. This tribal structure was really the backbone of social organization. It influenced land ownership, local power dynamics, dispute resolution, that sort of thing.
So it wasn't just a homogenous Kurdish population, but one organized along these tribal lines.
Precisely. And we also see connections outwards. By the 1800s, there's evidence of Kurds from Kurdog migrating and settling in Aleppo City.
And a distinct religious aspect developed, too.
Yes. A specific Sufi Kurdish Islamic tradition took root in the region. So this whole period, 16th to 18th centuries especially, seems really crucial for cementing the Kurdish demographic and social fabric of Afrin that would endure.
Okay. That leads us neatly into Event 5. Afrin's integration into the broader Ottoman administrative system, lasting right up until 1918.
Right. For roughly four centuries, Afrin was part of the Ottoman Empire. Administratively, it usually fell under the vilayet or province of Aleppo.
Though sometimes linked to Kilis.
Yes, occasionally it seems to have been administratively tied to the Sanjak of Kilis, which is just to the north, now in Turkey. These administrative boundaries could shift depending on imperial reorganizations or maybe just its position near the edge of jurisdictions.
But being part of this vast empire didn't necessarily mean total central control, especially in a mountainous area.
Probably not. The terrain, combined with that strong tribal presence we just discussed, likely allowed for a fair degree of local autonomy in practice, even if Ottoman laws and taxes technically applied.
But the Ottomans consistently acknowledged its Kurdish nature.
Yes, as we saw with the name Kurdog, that recognition seems consistent throughout the period.
And there were even instances of Kurdish elites rising high within the Ottoman system in that wider region.
Absolutely. The example of the Cumbulat family, sometimes written as Cumbulat, is key here. They were a powerful Kurdish family who actually served as governors of the entire vilayet of Aleppo for a time, around 1591 to 1607.
So it shows that Kurdish figures could be integrated into the highest levels of Ottoman provincial administration.
Exactly. It demonstrates a complex relationship, not just simple ruler and ruled. So the Ottoman period really embedded Afrin within the wider imperial structure, but did so while acknowledging and in some ways reinforcing its Kurdish identity.
All right, let's move to event number 6, the establishment of Afrin Town as a regional center. This happened relatively late in the 19th century.
Yes, which is interesting when you compare it to ancient sites like Sarras or Andara. For centuries, the settlement pattern in Kurdog was mostly villages scattered through the mountains.
So why did Afrin Town emerge when it did?
It likely relates to broader Ottoman trends in the 19th century, efforts towards modernizing administration, centralizing markets, maybe improving security along routes. Establishing small administrative centers was part of that.
But it started small.
Very small. One figure suggests only about 800 residents in 1929, even after the Ottomans were gone.
So its real growth came later?
Significantly later, under the French mandate. The French made Afrin Town the administrative capital of the district, the Kwaza. That really spurred its growth.
And infrastructure followed, like the bus station.
Yeah, the main square became the transport hub, the bus station. Development started spreading across the Afrin River from the original settlement on the hillside.
And what fueled its growth through the 20th century? Was it just administration?
Administration was key, but also the region's agricultural economy, especially olives and olive oil. Those provided an economic base. The population grew steadily, maybe around 7,000 by the late 1960s.
And satellite images confirm this expansion.
They do. You can see the built-up area growing significantly over time. So Afrin Town provided this central focus, administrative, economic transport that the region hadn't really had before in the same way.
Okay, now we hit the 20th century and some major geopolitical shifts. Event 7, the demarcation of the Syria-Turkey border, 1921 to 1923.
A truly pivotal moment. The Ottoman Empire had collapsed after World War I. The victorious Allied powers, mainly Britain and France, were redrawing the map of the Middle East based on agreements like Sykes-Picot.
And Turkey had fought its war of independence, establishing the modern republic.
Exactly. So France, which held the mandate for Syria, had to agree on a border with the new Turkish state led by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. This happened through the Ankara Agreement in 1921, and it was finalized in the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923.
And the result for Afrin?
The result was that the region of Kurdog, which had historical ties to Kilis province to the north, was formally cut off from it and placed entirely within French-mandated Syria.
This wasn't based on local wishes or ethnic lines, was it?
Not really. It was primarily about the interests of France and Turkey. Like many post-colonial borders, it cut across existing ethnic and economic landscapes. It was part of the wider fragmentation of Kurdish-populated lands among Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran.
So what were the immediate consequences for Afrin?
It severed those deep-rooted connections with Kilis. Overnight, Afrin became a borderland region within Syria, right up against Turkey. Given its predominantly Kurdish population, adjacent to Kurdish areas in Turkey, this immediately created a sensitive geopolitical situation. It set the stage for many future complexities.
That leads directly into our eighth event, the French Mandate period itself from 1920 to 1946.
Right. French forces occupied Syria in 1920, ending the short-lived Arab kingdom. The League of Nations granted France the mandate in 1922, tasking them with administering the territory and preparing it for eventual self-government.
And initially, France divided Syria up.
Yes, into several statelets. Afrin fell within the state of Aleppo. Later, France moved towards unifying Syria, although Lebanon and Hatay were kept separate. French policy often involved, managing or sometimes exploiting ethnic and religious differences.
But in Afrin's case, by recognizing its Kurdish character administratively, did the French inadvertently reinforce that identity within the new Syrian context?
That's a strong possibility. They administered it as a distinct district, often referred to by its Kurdish or Arabic names. And the French did invest in some development roads, agriculture, which benefited the region.
And they cemented Afrin town as the administrative center.
Yes, they really developed its role as the chef-lieu, or capital of the Khwaza.
This period also saw an important migration into Afrin.
It did. In the 1930s, significant numbers of Kurdish Alevi refugees arrived in the Mbeta area. They were fleeing state violence and persecution during the Dersim campaigns in Turkey.
That really underscores Afrin's role as a refuge, doesn't it? And the connection between Kurdish communities across that new border.
Absolutely. It highlights the porousness of the border in human terms, despite the political division. Of course, the mandate ended after World War II. France withdrew its troops in 1946, and Syria became a fully independent republic.
So Afrin completed its transition from Ottoman province to a district within a French mandate to finally being part of independent Syria.
A series of profound shifts in sovereignty and administration in just a few decades.
And that sets up our ninth event, another major external impact, Turkey's annexation of Hatay, and the resulting encirclement of Afrin, 1937-1939.
This was a huge development with immediate consequences for Afrin's geography. We're talking about the Sanjak of Alexandretta, historically part of the Aleppo Vilayet and included in Mandate Syria.
It had a mixed population, right? Turks, Arabs, Armenians.
Yes, a very mixed population. France, under pressure and likely wanting to secure Turkey's neutrality or even support as war loomed in Europe, essentially negotiated its transfer to Turkey.
How did that unfold?
It was a staged process. An agreement in May 1937 granted the Sanjak autonomy. It formally separated from Syria in November 1937. Then there was a controversial election and referendum process leading to the declaration of the Republic of Hatay in September 1938.
A short-lived republic.
Very short-lived. By June 1939, the Hatay parliament voted to join Turkey, and it was formally annexed, becoming Turkey's Hatay province.
And for Afrin, sitting just north of Hatay,
the impact was dramatic. Afrin, which previously bordered Turkey only to its north and west, suddenly found itself bordered by Turkey to the south as well. It became almost completely surrounded.
Like a finger of Syrian territory poking into Turkey.
Exactly. A geographical salient, almost an enclave. Its only connections to the rest of Syria were now narrow strips of land to the east towards Azaz and southeast towards Mount Simeon.
That must have massively increased its strategic sensitivity.
Immensely. The length of its border with Turkey multiplied. Any instability or political development in Afrin was now happening right on Turkey's doorstep, along a much longer frontier. This geographical isolation was a direct result of French and Turkish geopolitical calculations.
And it established a precedent, didn't it? Turkey expanding its territory at Syria's expense through negotiation with a major European power.
A very important precedent to note, yes.
Okay, that brings us to our final pre-2010 event, number 10, the era of Bayeth rule in Syria, from the coup in 1963 onwards.
This period, lasting decades, was defined by the Bayeth Party's Arab nationalist ideology and generally discriminatory policies towards ethnic and religious minorities, including Syria's Kurds.
We know that in other parts of Syria, particularly the northeast, Jazeera, there were some very harsh specific policies targeting Kurds. What about Afrin?
It's interesting. The sources we have suggest that Afrin largely avoided the two most notorious policies. The 1962 census in Hasaka province that stripped about 120,000 Kurds of their citizenship.
Making them stateless, Ajaniv.
Right. And the Arab Belt project starting in the 1970s, which involved confiscating Kurdish land along the border in Jazeera and settling Arab families there.
Why would Afrin have been spared those specific, very aggressive measures?
It's hard to say for sure. Maybe its geographical isolation played a part, or the mountainous terrain made large-scale land confiscation and resettlement harder. Perhaps different local power dynamics, or simply the Ba'ath regime prioritizing the resource-richer Jazeera region for these demographic engineering projects.
But avoiding the worst didn't mean everything was fine for Kurds in Afrin.
Absolutely not. Afrin's Kurds were still subject to the Ba'ath regime's broader policies of cultural suppression and political marginalization that affected Kurds across Syria.
What did that look like in practice?
Well, the Kurdish language was banned in schools and official settings. Publishing in Kurdish was forbidden. Celebrating cultural events like Newroz was often restricted or banned outright.
And the state actively promoted an Arab nationalist ideology.
Yes, an ideology that essentially denied the existence of a distinct Kurdish identity within Syria. They were portrayed simply as Arabs or recent immigrants. There was even an attempt in 1977 to officially rename the region from Jabal al-Akrad to Jabal al-Uruba, Mountain of Arabism.
Did that stick?
Not really. The old names persisted in local and even sometimes official use, but it shows the intent.
And politically, were local Kurds able to participate?
Participation was very limited. Key positions in local government, security forces, administration, these were often filled by Ba'ath party loyalists, frequently Arabs from other parts of Syria rather than local Kurds. There was a definite sense of being ruled by outsiders and excluded from power.
So even without the mass denaturalization or the Arab Belt, the Ba'ath era in Afrin was still one of significant political exclusion and cultural denial.
Definitely. And this experience undoubtedly fostered a sense of collective grievance and strengthened Kurdish identity in opposition to the state, laying the groundwork for political mobilization that would come later.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rooj Bosh Hat.
Rooj Bosh. Ah, fantastic timing. That smells wonderful.
Doesn't it just, there's really nothing like proper chai. It's such a core part of life here, isn't it? More than just a drink.
Oh, absolutely. It's about hospitality, taking a moment, discussion. You know, tea houses traditionally were such important social hubs. Places where news was exchanged, ideas debated.
Totally. And the preparation itself is a ritual, sometimes with cardamom, sometimes simpler. Everyone has their own slight variation, just holding the warm glass, that sweet aroma.
It forces you to slow down for a minute. And you mentioned hospitality offering chai is such a fundamental gesture of welcome. I've heard stories too, like refusing it can be seen as quite rude.
It really can. It speaks volumes about shared culture and respect. It's a small thing, but it connects people.
And in contexts where maybe other forms of cultural expression are difficult, sometimes these everyday traditions, like sharing chai, take on even more significance. A quiet affirmation of identity.
Well said. This is perfect. Let's just enjoy this for a moment.
Agreed. Cheers.
Cheers.
Lovely.
All right. That was a welcome pause. So as we wrap up this discussion, we've covered a lot of ground, those 10 significant historical moments shaping Afrin before 2010.
We really have. And you can see these recurring themes, can't you? Afrin's deep history, its strategic importance drawing in empires.
The way its Kurdish identity consolidated and was recognized, sometimes formally, sometimes informally.
And then the huge impact of modern borders being drawn by outside powers, the whole Hatay situation radically changing its geography.
And finally, that experience under the Ba'ath regime, avoiding the absolute worst policies, perhaps, but still facing significant marginalization and cultural pressure.
Exactly. And understanding all of that, the Roman roads, the Ottoman administration, the French mandate decisions, the Ba'athist policies, it all provides the essential background, the foundation for making sense of the dramatic events that have unfolded in Afrin since 2010.
It really does. It makes you think, doesn't it? About how these layers of history pile up, how decisions made centuries ago or decades ago by distant powers continue to echo and shape lives today.
It's a powerful reminder.
So maybe something for you, our listener, to ponder is just that. The sheer weight of external forces in shaping a region's identity and destiny, like we've seen in Afrin. But also, perhaps, think about the resilience of that local identity, that culture, persisting through all these changes and pressures. How do those threads of history continue to play out right now?